Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 112, Moko Rangito Hadede, Part 2. In my last episode, I told you the story of 3-year-old Moko Rangito Hadede, who was brutally abused for weeks by his caretakers, Tanya Shaler and David Hadiwa, who were ultimately found guilty in Moko's death and sentenced to 17 years each in New Zealand prison. This week, you'll hear about the killer's attempt to appeal their sentences, the coroner's inquest into the circumstances surrounding Moko's death, and the legacy of change and hope inspired by the little boy with the big, bright smile. This is part 2 of the disturbing story of Moko Rangito Hadede. First up, I'd like to give shout-outs to my newest patrons, Christina A. from Avondale, Arizona, Artie B. from Seattle, Washington, and from a top-secret location, Happy Anne Marie. Thank you all so much for helping keep the show going. To make a pledge, you can visit patreon.com/stlcpod. Last week, I left off with the sentencing of 26-year-old Tanya Shaler and 43-year-old David Hadiwa, who were inexplicably allowed to plead guilty to manslaughter instead of facing their original charge of murder for Moko's savage beating death. This is the rest of Moko's story. On the evening of the sentencing hearing, reporter Duncan Garner once again spoke with Moko's mom, Nicola Dalipacki. When Duncan asked Nicola's opinion on the sentence, she said,
"I accept it. I am not satisfied by it. I will be going to every parole hearing and opposing their parole every time they apply."
You're going to be there?
Absolutely.
You want them to do the 17 years?
I want them to do life for the gruesome they did to my child.
What did you see when you turned to Tanya? Because you made eye contact with her, didn't you?
Smirk. Happy. She succeeded, that's why I tried my hardest not to show any tear. Never fear. She made me angry. She made me very angry.
What did you make of their remorse or lack of remorse?
There was none.
Have you had anything?
There is none. All they did was defend themselves through their lawyers. There was no sorry, nothing. There's no remorse.
Have you heard anything from them at all?
Not at all.
What did you make of them attempting to blame Moko for being a, quote, difficult
disgusting
child?
Poor excuses for humans. Disgusting, a 3-year-old, helpless, defenceless child. It's premeditated murder. I heard the admission from the Crown. It's premeditated murder. For that judge to sit there and give out what she gave out, which I respect and I accept, it's not good enough. is Muko's mum. She has the power and the position. Yet laws do override, but she sat in that seat, in that hot spot, in that moment, in that time, she could have made a better decision.
A longer sentence?
Mm-hmm. A life sentence. Muko never comes back. What they did to Muko never ever changes. After 17 years, he's still gone.
Nicola expressed her gratitude for those who participated in the March for Muko events at dozens of courthouses around the country.
Thank you for the turnouts that went viral with all the high courts today for Muko. It's continuing. This is the beginning of the evolution.
The reporter asked what was next for Nicola.
It's going through this trauma for nearly a year now without their only guardian. So that will be my main focus. Yeah, working before them, but fix my babies.
They need their mum.
Yeah. Get them to believe that it's not true. What CYF are doing to them and what they are brainwashing them, it's not true. That I do love them, and I am trying.
After the sentencing, Attorney General Christopher Finlayson finally gave some semblance of an explanation for the reduced charges, saying that Tanya and David accepting the manslaughter pleas and admitting to the facts in the case meant prosecutors could push for a sentence that reflected what happened to Muko. Clear as mud? Mr. Finlayson explained,
without the guilty pleas, the full details may not have otherwise come to light. Based on the evidence available for trial, there was a substantial risk that one or both of the defendants would not be convicted of the legal charge of murder or manslaughter.
The president of the New Zealand Bar Association, Clive Elliott QC, which stands for Queen's Counsel, also defended the Crown's decision, saying,
the tragic cases involving the death of a baby or an infant often present evidential challenges for the prosecution. If the admissible evidence does not meet the threshold to secure a conviction on a particular charge, it will be necessary to downgrade the charge to one where the threshold is satisfied.
After the sentencing, it was revealed that prior to Moko's death, Tanya Shaler had been convicted 6 times for shoplifting, the first incident taking place in 2012. While that wasn't terribly shocking in and of itself, the next detail certainly was. David Hadiwa had racked up a stunning 111 convictions and had been in and out of prison since 1991. His past crimes included burglary, willful damage, possession of a knife in a public place, contravening a protection order, male assaults female, aggravated robbery, breach of parole, theft, receiving stolen property, escaping custody, and a laundry list of driving charges and bail breaches. You might remember he had just gotten out of prison when he moved back in with Tanya in their new home in Taupo. Also in 2016, Moko's father, Jordan Rengito Hadede, was charged with committing a dangerous act with intent to injure, unlawful possession of a firearm, and driving offenses after he shot at a stopped vehicle in Tokoroa. He was sentenced to 31 months in prison. During his sentence, Jordan completed a rehab program that helped him turn his life around, allowing him to work on his communication issues, his consideration for others, and understanding the consequences of his impulsive actions. After the parole board reviewed his case in 2017, hearing that Jordan was well-behaved and polite in prison, he was released. And now for a quick break from my sponsors.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
In November of 2016, Tanya and David asked the Court of Appeals to reduce their sentences. During the court hearing for the appeal, which was attended by Nicola Dalipaki, her brother Anthony, and several supporters, Tanya's attorney, Ron Mansfield, suggested to the court that the trial judge should have used 16 years as a starting point for sentencing and then allowed time discounts for Tanya's guilty plea, her mental illness, and her remorse. He said his client's sentence should have a cap of 12 years, not 17, and that her mental illness should be taken into greater consideration because her mental state was the reason he felt her crime didn't belong among the most serious cases. Her mental illness, including adjustment disorder, anxiety, and depression, were caused in part by past trauma as well as the stress of caring for 6 children, he said, and the court should recognize that Tanya's mental health was the reason for the crime, not some desire to be sadistic. The introduction of 2 children with
complex issues
to the household led to Tanya's inability to cope. Otherwise, he said, she had been a good mother to her own children.
We do not punish the unwell as we punish the intended. This distinction is, in my submission, crucial in this case. The appellant, Shayla, was extremely ill at the time. Prior to becoming unwell, she was an otherwise good mother who led, as her means dictated, a productive life whereby she was intending to do the best she could for her family and her own children.
The problem with that, Justice Reese Harrison said, was the level of gratuitous violence involved in Moko's death.
And I accept that she was not in a mentally sound state. But it's not enough to talk about them. Many people suffer from anxiety. Many people suffer from depression. Many people suffer from disassociation. They don't carry out what I said to you before was a prolonged, cruel, gratuitous course of violence towards a 3-year-old child.
Mr. Mansfield said he couldn't argue that point, but he countered that Tanya's mental illness was the reason her violent behavior occurred when it had never manifested before. He read aloud to the court a report from a doctor who said that when asked about remorse, Tanya had been heavily medicated, which could have contributed to her apparent lack of emotion.
What I am promoting is her mental health as a mitigating factor. And this report clearly shows that she suffered from extremely poor mental health and that it was directly linked to the offending.
For his part, David's attorney, Harry Edward, said his issue was also with the starting point Justice Katz had used in calculating his client's sentence, and that if Tanya's sentence was reduced, David's must be as well, because he was a secondary party in the offense. Crown lawyer Brendan Horsley argued that the doctor's report about Tanya was based on misleading information and that its importance was overblown. What Tanya told the doctor, according to Mr. Horsley, was designed to minimize the crime itself and especially her part in it. The only logical conclusion, he said, was that she was responsible for the crime. The report, he said, really only provided an explanation for how the assaults on Moko began and progressed, but did not excuse them or explain why they occurred.
When you couple that with the fact that this is ongoing abuse, numerous incidences, then the dissociative state becomes almost meaningless because it's not coupled with a lack of insight. She knows what she's done and she fails to stop it.
Mr. Horsley said there was no question that David Hadiwa carried a hatred for Moko and didn't want him in the household, and that he therefore subjected the little boy to dehumanizing, degrading treatment in an apparent attempt to break Moko. He said,
he felt Moko was defiant and did everything he could to crush that child.
As for Tanya, the Crown lawyer said, she supported David unquestioningly, casting aside her obligation to care for and protect Moko in favor of her relationship with David. Keep in mind, Mr. Horsley told the court, that in the days before his death, Moko was unable to walk. His face was swelling, his black eyes worsening, and although it was blatantly obvious he needed medical assistance, his caregiver, Tanya Shaler, did nothing about it, fearing she would lose her own children if she did so.
There is nothing to say the mental illness stopped her from doing that.
At the end of the hearing, the court reserved its decision until a later date. Tanya and David's appeals were dismissed in March of 2017 when the Court of Appeals said their sentences were appropriate and the two should consider themselves fortunate that they weren't sentenced to life imprisonment, considering the
duration, cruelty, and physical depravity of this offending by 2 adults acting together against a defenseless 3-year-old child.
In April of 2017, After enacting, legislation was passed. The agency known as Child, Youth, and Family, or CYF, which had been referred to as
the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff
for its tendency to be reactive instead of proactive, was eliminated and replaced by the Ministry for Vulnerable Children, Oranga Tamariki. In November of 2017, legendary New Zealand singer Tina Cross released a song called Another Little One, inspired by Moko's story. I'm crossing my fingers to avoid a copyright claim because I'm going to play a short clip of the song, but in case I have to remove it, I'll include a link to the YouTube video in the show notes for this episode.
I'll fight for you, little one. You cannot voice your pain. Sleep tight, little one. You didn't die in vain.
The single was donated to Shine, the national domestic abuse charity, to help raise much-needed funds leading up to the busy Christmas season. Ms. Cross said,
I really feel it's got a powerful and poignant message, and I hope it's going to make a huge impact and statement, and people will really think hard about our young children who have been abused and who have died. Moko was the inspiration, I'm sad to say, but what fueled the passion and fueled me to write it was what is happening to our young children, and there are many.
Moko's mom, Nicola, attended Shine's Christmas party, which was also the official launch of the song, where Tina was set to perform the song. Nicola said,
When I was first approached by Shine regarding the tribute song, written and performed by Tina Cross, I was understandably moved to tears. It has been an incredible struggle for me since the death of my little one, Moko. It has been only through the continued support of close friends and Shine that I have found strength in myself to better myself. I believe that the work that Shine does was and is absolutely instrumental in my ability to make many positive changes in my life. I appreciate the sentiment of the tribute by Ms. Cross and hope that the song will raise domestic violence awareness. If only one person hears the song and reaches out to Shine, then a life or lives will possibly be saved.
On December 11, 2017, the results were released of an inquest performed by Rotorua coroner Wallace Bain into the circumstances leading up to and surrounding Moko's death. The inquest consisted of two phases. During the first, the coroner would review the evidence correlating to the High Court findings of fact. In this phase, Coroner Bain received detailed evidence from Detective Inspector Lewis Warner, who also provided a thorough, in-depth summary of the events leading up to Moko's death, in addition to providing the court all of the pertinent documentation, including post-mortem reports and toxicology reports. The second phase would consist of court hearings, during which expert witnesses would testify about what had occurred and what could be done to prevent such tragedies in the future. The inquest revealed there were numerous red flags in Moko's case that were either ignored or overlooked. One major flaw was that despite all the reports of concern submitted regarding Tanya Shaler and the children in her care, Moko never received a visit from any organization. Moko's older sister told a social worker at the Maori Women's Refuge named Trina Manama that Tanya abused Moko, but the social worker did not take action. Ms. Marama, who never met Moko, told police Moko's 7-year-old sister, who she described as always well-dressed and carrying a homemade lunch, was enrolled in one of her refuge classes in June of 2015. According to evidence presented by Detective Inspector Lou Warner, Moko's sister told the social worker she and Tanya had been hitting Moko. Ms. Marama described the little girl telling her,
Auntie Tanya would punch Moko, but she made sure to say that the punches didn't hurt.
Ms. Marama also told police that Moko's sister told her Tanya also hit her when the siblings were fighting. She also told me that Auntie Tanya would punch her to stop the arguing. I immediately asked her to demonstrate what she meant by punch, and she folded the tips of her fingers and pushed my shoulder. Ms. Marama told police she discussed this with her manager, and they agreed Tanya's treatment of the girl was a disciplinary measure to protect one child from the other. All of this was recorded in Ms. Marama's police statement, which went on to say that the social worker then asked Tanya about it, but Tanya denied hitting Moko. At that point, Ms. Marama changed her story to the police, saying she never spoke to Tanya. No report of concern was filed regarding the disclosure of Moko's sister. The social worker came under fire when this information became public. She told Maori TV's Native Affairs program,
There were no signs or alarming signs that Moko was being abused.
She said in media interviews that Moko's sister never said anything about Tanya hitting Moko, and she later said in a brief of evidence to the coroner that her statement to police was either
inaccurately written or understood.
Her first statement about Tanya punching Moko, however, was verified by another social worker who witnessed the original conversation with police, according to a report by Detective Senior Sergeant John Wilson that was presented to the coroner. The report read,
"This retraction is clearly as a result of the social worker realizing she should have reported what were obviously signs that child abuse was going on in the Shaler-Hadiwa household."
During the expert phase of the inquest, Nicola Daly-Packey testified about any precautions she may have taken before leaving her children with Tanya and how well she knew the woman.
"Well, I didn't do a police background check and I didn't ask all the social workers what was going on with the mental health. I just made an assumption as knowing her from previous early childhood that she would be safe opposed to putting them into a gang life. We had lunches at the lake. We'd spent, I think, a Christmas together at the lake. Mm-hmm. Shouted them a barbecue, bought presents for her kids."
In her testimony, Nicola called out the social worker by name, asking why Ms. Marama did not pick up that abuse was happening despite being an experienced support worker.
"Trina Marama has 12 years' experience as a trained social worker and says not once did she pick up on any signs that something was not right in one of the worst child killings in New Zealand history."
When given the opportunity to advise others who may be living in domestic violence situations, Nicola said,
"Organize all your personal information, your ID, money, any identification that you will need in the future. Have an emergency plan. There's also an app available now that you can have a screen cloud over it for those type of situations. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be ashamed of it. It's something that I'm still accepting. It's something that I didn't want to be sharing with the courts. Something I didn't want to talk about until my biography in 2025. But unfortunately, it's come forward earlier, and I don't want anybody else to look at me as any weaker than what I have portrayed in trying to help families in domestic violence. I'd also like to say, when you leave, don't look back. Keep going. Don't give up on your dreams. Get that career. Get that education. Go to uni. It's all possible after everything you've gone through. Not living proof. That's all I have to say, sir."
Nicola also gave some very personal and powerful testimony, saying,
"I accept that I, as a victim of domestic violence, made mistakes. My children and I live with those mistakes every day. I believe the policies and procedures assisted in bad decision-making that led to my son's death. I will also continue to advocate for families of domestic violence and encourage them to get help free of judgment or criticism. Perhaps if I had been judged less harshly, Moko would be in my arms today.
I will continue to better myself and my children and for our future. I hope to continue to make positive changes so that I can have my children return to my care or at the very least be allowed to contact them."
The following day, Ms. Marama herself testified, saying that Tanya Shaler must be a good actress because based on her conversations with Tanya, Ms. Marama never suspected Moko was being abused.
"If I had noticed any signs of adult abuse, I would have reported it without delay.
I never knew Tanya was punching Moko. That never was disclosed to me. I knew of sibling rivalry, nothing more."
Ms. Marama said Tanya told her she stepped in to break up fights between Moko and his sister and had pushed the girl, but Ms. Marama thought that was acceptable.
"I'm not condoning anything. I'm telling you what happened. Absolutely don't condone any sort of abuse. I didn't see a push on the shoulder to stop brother and sister fighting as an assault."
On the stand, she claimed she thought any bruises on the children were from them punching each other because of sibling rivalry. The first she heard of violent abuse was on the night Moko died. She actually testified,
"I don't honestly know whether I would do anything differently, presented with the same set of circumstances."
Children's Commissioner Judge Andrew Beecroft also gave expert testimony, saying,
"It seems fair to say that if CYF and or Starship Hospital had taken a different or more proactive approach to the issue of finding safe care for Moko and his sister in Auckland, the situation for Moko could have been very different."
Lawyer David Dothwaite, who also helped Coroner Bain during the earlier inquiry into the 2007 child abuse death of 3-year-old Nia Glassie, read out a summary of facts in the case.
"So the children in the house observed that Moko had been punched, kicked and slapped. They observed him being bitten multiple times on the arms and face with a degree of force so hard that it caused his skin to come off and his face to bleed. The evidence that Your Honour has before you says that in the 4 days leading up to his death, he was continually physically assaulted. The main event that caused Moko's death was stomping on his abdomen and stomach with significant force. Two of the children present witnessed this and said it was really, really hard and that Moko was groaning and expelling bursts of air. The pathologist established that he had lethal injuries causing his death, which were lacerations and hemorrhage deep within his abdomen.
Coroner Bain responded,
"It appears near glassy, and what happened to her is kindergarten compared to what you have just read out."
Moko's paternal grandmother, or Kuia, Nikki Rangito Hadidi, testified about trying to step in to help her grandchildren, but being stymied, saying,
"I screamed and yelled, but no one heard me or helped me. My Moko screamed and yelled, but no one heard him or helped him. I have no more screaming or yelling. I only have tears from within my heart and soul."
"You didn't help me either. All I basically got was that there was an investigation and putting my hand up to have them meant nothing. Please tell me why no one bothered to check on them after a complaint was made against the mother, just to ensure their well-being. Tania had 4 children of her own."
At the end of the second phase of the inquest, before rising from the judge's bench, Coroner Bain said,
"To Moko's mom at the back of the court, our sympathies to you again. I know you've lost your little boy, but as a result of this inquest, I hope it will help other little children being lost."
As beautifully written by investigative journalist Jared Savage for the New Zealand Herald,
the closing remarks were a touch of humanity after 3 days of dark, sometimes detached evidence as lawyers and professionals analyzed the life and death of Moko Rangito Hadidi from every angle. The wider ills of society, the dysfunctional home Moko lived in, the horrendous list of injuries which killed him, and the many missed opportunities to save the 3-year-old. Listening to all the depressing details was Nicola Dallipacchi. She sat in the Rotorua District Court, smartly dressed, with dignity, as her life was laid bare for the world to see.
At the conclusion of the inquest, Coroner Bain released the results in a written report, in which he recommended the establishment of a registry to monitor all New Zealand children under the age of 5. The same recommendation had been made after Nia Glassy's death, which was another high-profile criminal case. After Nia was abused and eventually killed by her mother's boyfriend and his brothers, Coroner Bain led an inquest into Nia's death, including in his report the necessity of monitoring all
under 5s.
In Moko's inquest report, the coroner said,
"That has to apply with even more force today."
If the various social services agencies involved with Tanya Shaler's family had closely monitored the situation, the coroner wrote, they would have found Tanya
in distress with depression and mental issues and assaulting Moko, another caregiver recently released from jail with a history of domestic violence.
In the report, the coroner noted that since Nia Glassy's death, the New Zealand police conducted a number of reviews into the management and investigation of child abuse, and there had been significant changes made to processes and procedures. Still, much more work needed to be done, including early intervention, the use of Maori providers for Maori families, and taking a family-wide approach to keeping children safe, since in many cases it was apparent that other family members knew about the abuse children were enduring but didn't report it. Research showed that for every abused child, 6 adults knew about the abuse. And now a quick word from my sponsors.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
An alarming statistic included in the coroner's inquest was quoted from Inspector Mark Loper, one of the experts who gave testimony during the inquest, who said,
"There have been 94 child homicides involving children aged between 0 to 14 years in New Zealand from 2007 to 2015.
During the inquest, the court commented that this was a
shocking indictment on child abuse in New Zealand.
With a population of just 4.5 million people, this statistic meant the country's rate of child abuse deaths within families was one of the worst in the developed world. On average, one child was killed every 5 weeks in New Zealand, most being under 5 years old, and 90% of those deaths were perpetrated by someone the child knew.
A child is admitted to a New Zealand hospital every single day with injuries arising from either assault, neglect, or maltreatment. Nearly half of them are under 5 years old.
According to UNICEF, in a study of child maltreatment death rates in 27 developed nations, New Zealand is ranked 22nd, meaning there are only 5 nations ranked worse. Portugal is by far the worst, followed by Mexico, with the United States coming in 3rd worst. Statistically, Maori children are disproportionately abused. Nearly 60% of children in state care by the time they reach the age of 5 are Maori, and Maori children are disproportionately represented in families with high levels of need. According to Tipuni Kokeri, the government's principal policy advisor on Maori well-being and development, although Maori make up only 17.1% of New Zealand's population, 61% of children in state care are Maori. 46% of total children with physical abuse findings are Maori, as are 55% of total children with emotional abuse findings, 37% of children with sexual abuse findings, and 53% of children with neglect findings. Of 37 children who died from abuse and neglect between 2009 and 2012, 16 of these, or 43%, were Maori children. Maori families are also disproportionately more likely to live in poverty than other New Zealand families, which is widely thought to contribute to child abuse and neglect. Children's Commissioner Judge Andrew Beecroft said,
"There is a dark side to New Zealand, and there's been a growing realization over the past 5 to 10 years that our family violence rates, child abuse rates, youth suicide rates are all interconnected, and all roads lead back to genuine disadvantage. There is genuine disadvantage here which most people don't see. We have kids living in damp, moldy homes, without raincoats, without food. The list goes on."
One unsettling thing I noticed during my research for this episode was that politicians and the media appeared to weaponize these statistics to demonize the Maori, who were blamed for a
culture of violence
within families. Reporter Duncan Garner wrote in a column for the Dominion Post,
"So why does this happen? More often than not, it's because this is the product of the underclass. These people live in third and fourth generation benefit families. They were beaten, and their parents were beaten, and so it continues."
In New Zealand, being on the benefit is similar to someone in the U.S. being on welfare, disability, unemployment, or other government assistance. The column continued,
"They have not been shown love. They have not been cuddled. They have no idea how to be parents. Monsters breed more monsters. We need to surround these families with support and teach them how to parent and how to love. It will be hard. They will be learning something foreign."
To me, that reads as condescending and dehumanizing, likening low-income families to little more than animals. The general idea is great. Yes, let's provide support to the most vulnerable among us, but the execution is offensive, to say the least. Mr. Garner continued in a second column a few weeks later,
"There will always be bad parents, so we must intervene in these families early. We need someone to teach love. Short of stopping these people breeding, we need to teach them what the generations before have failed to do. If the cycle is not broken, it will continue. This means getting in early and living with them, like a surrogate third parent. It's expensive and time-consuming and hard, but it will save lives."
Duncan Garner was far from the only member of the media making statements like these. Right-wing commentator and author Alan Duff, who is the son of a Maori mother and a European father, wrote in the New Zealand Herald that
"Some Maori have no moral values because they're not taught them. Violence is perfectly acceptable behavior, indeed admired, whether it's king hitting a stranger in a pub, beating up the wife or partner, thrashing their children."
Regardless of the intentions behind these statements, as I said before, it's the approach that needs some refinement, especially when the Maori community already deals with more than its share of racism and classism. The coroner's inquest into Moko's death examined child poverty as well. former chief executive of Women's Refuge, Mirapika Rakawa Tate, testified during the inquest hearing.
They live in Struggle Street every day. That's reality for so many of our families. Tempers get frayed, and the biff and the boot comes out. It's a tragedy, but it's happening.
She urged greater funding for non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, which had a better chance of success in connecting with dysfunctional families than any government agency could hope to have.
They are the ones people will talk to. Who talks to them about a way forward? Who tells them, this is not your destiny? You are not meant to be living on your knees.
Finally, the inquest concluded
that major steps need to be taken, and with urgency. The court does have confidence from the evidence it has heard that there is a plan in the wider sense with the steps that are being taken.
One point everyone at the inquest agreed on was that Oranga Tamariki alone could not keep children safe. Ms. Rakawa Tate said,
it is the family responsibility, and if we are Maori, then it's Whanau, Hapu, and Iwi. Don't internalize everything. There is no shame in saying, I'm not coping. Don't hide and hope it's going to get better. Put your hand up and try to get help.
In a statement released to the media in response to the inquiry, the Ministry for Children, Oranga Tamariki, made no mention of the multitude of red flags missed by CYF and other agencies involved with Tanya Shaler's family. They said the coroner's recommendation of compulsory monitoring for under fives would need to be a multi-agency approach and was something for the government to consider.
We feel deep sympathy for everyone who loved this little boy. The particular circumstances affected everyone. The tragedy was Moko died after repeated abuse, and throughout this, no one heard his voice.
More than 2 years after the inquest, in March of 2020, Coroner Wallace Bain retired after 28 years of service. In a written statement, Coroner Bain, who was a registered pharmacist, full-time coroner of 13 years, and former mayor of Waitomo, said it was an honor to serve as a coroner and work with such a wonderful team.
To my fellow coroners, judges, staff, and local press, you do outstanding work. You have been a wonderful team to work with. After climbing the mountain, I can finally enjoy the view. I will retire from work, but not from life.
His statement also read,
I'm deeply concerned at the horrific child abuse figures in our country, along with the increasing suicide statistics, especially youth suicide.
In August of 2020, Nicola Dalipaki filed a Waitangi Tribunal claim as part of an inquiry by the Tribunal into Oranga Tamariki. The Tribunal was looking at why a disparity between the number of uplifts, which means the forced taking of children from their caregivers, of Maori and non-Maori children existed, whether legislative changes made in 2017 had helped, and what policy and practices were required to ensure the Treaty of Waitangi and its principles were being honored. The treaty, which was first signed in 1840, is an agreement signed between the British Crown and Maori chiefs or rangatira. It was drafted with the intention of establishing a British governor of New Zealand while still recognizing Maori ownership of their lands, forests, and other possessions, and giving Maori the same rights as British subjects. Nicola's attorney and friend of 15 years, Arama Napo Lipscomb, said,
we will be utilizing the opportunity to highlight the serious breaches and failings of Oranga Tamariki, CYFS at the time, to investigate allegations that Moko was at risk.
She said the stories of several claimants she represented would show there was no other logical option than to disestablish Oranga Tamariki.
You could argue further that Oranga Tamariki is a breach of the treaty because it is not one based on partnership. It is designed by the Crown without partnership with Maori. The principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, in short, talk about partnership, protection, and participation. The current models and its predecessors being Oranga Tamariki, child, youth, and family, etc., are examples of models of ethnocentricity. The ethnocentricity model does not work for Maori, and that is why Maori are disproportionately overrepresented in state care.
The attorney then said the only way forward was to employ a multifaceted approach led by Whanau, Hapu, and Iwi, focusing on a restorative process, empowering Whanau instead of punishing them. As of this recording, the Tribunal's inquiry is ongoing. In April of 2021, the Taupo community was disgusted when a memorial remembering children lost to abuse, including Moko, was vandalized. The memorial, consisting of a commemoration plaque called Angels of NAI, Non-Accidental Injuries, and a long bench in a koru or spiral shape wrapped around a tree at the corner of Spa Road and Gascoigne Street. The ends of several of the wood planks making up the bench were snapped off. The Taupo District Council quickly got to work repairing it. One bit of excellent news in this story is that Moko's father, Jordan Rengito Hadede, has evidently made a huge effort toward self-improvement. He is reportedly no longer involved in the Black Power gang. In July of 2021, One News released an article about a book called She Is Not Your Rehab by a barber, Matt Brown, and his wife, Sarah. She Is Not Your Rehab is more than a book. It's also an anti-violence movement. In 2019, Matt Brown gave an impressive and well-received TEDx talk as a survivor of family and childhood sexual abuse who hosts a men's support group from his Christchurch barbershop. According to the She Is Not Your Rehab Facebook page,
She Is Not Your Rehab is a non-religious and non-legislative movement whose mission is to impact the culture around abusive relationships, domestic violence, and unhealthy ideals of masculinity.
She Is Not Your Rehab means, according to a post on the Facebook page,
1. She is not responsible for your emotional rehabilitation. 2. Your healing is your responsibility and yours to take initiative for and manage. 3. Any healing needed for you cannot come at the expense of her healing, health, and well-being. 4. She can support you, but she can never do more for you than you were prepared to do for yourself. 5. Regardless of what anyone has done to you, it is now time for you to take ownership of your own life and be committed to living it wholeheartedly enough to do any work needed. Your childhood trauma wasn't your fault, but your healing is now your responsibility. 6. True change comes from genuine growth. Growth happens once we heal. Healing starts when we begin to feel our pain. 7. Hurt people inevitably hurt people because what we will not transform, we transmit on those around us. And healed people do indeed heal people. The question is, will you have the courage to heal?
At the book launch in July of 2021, Jordan talked to a reporter about how the movement helped him overcome his violent upbringing and his son's murder. During his interview, an artist inked the words, "She is not your rehab," on Jordan's forearm.
It's going to be a reminder of how far I've come in my life. All my other ones were for intimidation and to show that I didn't really care what anyone thought of me. But this is a tattoo of the new me and the person who has learned how to deal with emotions, trauma, anger and violence.
Jordan discussed how Matt Brown had furthered his quest for self-improvement.
To have someone like Matt there, who has felt our pain, who has been through all of that, it warms my heart. And we need more people like him. I was raised in Tokoroa. It's just all we know there is being a bushman and a gang member. And if you haven't got an education, then... I chose to go on a different path when I moved down here, and that's what led me to Matt.
Jordan talked about what the program entailed.
I had to stare another man in the eyes for 3 minutes, you know, and like your natural instinct is punch him in the face, you know. So they were teaching you how to break those walls and deal with those emotions without the violence.
Jordan's wife, Lariah, talked about the improvements he had made.
He's just the person that he's always destined to be and the father that he's always meant to be. And, Matt's been an incredible inspiration in our life. He's had a lot of childhood trauma, been through so much stuff, so I thought maybe this could be the thing that really helps him. And he, I think, was in a position, in a situation in his life where he was grasping for anything, any kind of help.
Matt Brown told a reporter why he chose to help people.
I want men to take responsibility for their own healing so we don't transmit our pain onto our children and our partners.
He and his wife even raised money to give copies of his book to prisoners.
When this gets in the hands of the gentleman behind the wire, I would probably cry first because they represent my father, they represent my uncles, my cousins, my brothers.
When asked how Jordan's progress made him feel, Matt said,
"It makes me emotional, knowing his story and the man that he is today."
The following month, Jordan was in the news again after he was asked to leave the Richard Pierce Tavern in Timaru because of his facial tattoo, which consists of the Roman numerals XIIIX. He was in Timaru at the time because the Christchurch construction company he worked for was doing contract work there.
We heard that the karaoke was pretty good at the Richard Pierce, so we all pitched in, spent $30 on an Uber, went there, I went and brought one beer, the lady asked me about my tattoos, she served me, and then I went back to my table, went back to get another beer, and then the owner came and then she said she had a problem, and said that in her policy that they're not allowed facial tats in there, or they don't allow facial tats, but I was watching other men with facial tats walking there right in front of me, so I asked her what I did wrong, and she couldn't say what I did wrong. She just kept saying it was the tattoo, and then she rang the police, and four cop cars came and escorted me and my workmates back to North Park. Well, don't get me wrong, like if I had gang patches all over my face or very intimidating facial tattoos and I was being aggressive, then I would understand, but even the cops said that they couldn't understand why I had to leave, and they were actually good. The guy Paul, who gave me a ride home, he was actually thanking me for the way I handled things, and said by, you know, looking at my record and that, he thanked me for not handling it the way that I used to back in the day. So I don't know, I'd just like them not to discriminate us and treat us like we're different, if you know what I mean. We're just normal people. I go to pubs throughout all of the South Island, and they tell me I've got a contagious smile, and everyone plays pool with me. So, and our boys, I don't understand what the problem was. It was just another night to us, and it ended up with four cop cars escorting us all back to North Park Motel, and we just went to that pub and played pool there. But we didn't get the karaoke, so I wouldn't be recommending that pub to anyone else, I'll tell you now.
The tavern's operations manager, Matthew Freeman, defended the tavern's position in a news article, saying,
"We allow people with culture-related facial tattoos all the time, but our policy is that we do not tolerate gang-related and intimidating tattoos."
At long last, near the end of 2021, Moko's older sister was reunited with her family, going to live with Jordan, Lariah, and her little sister. Around the same time, the couple announced they were expecting another baby. Moko's older brother has improved quite a bit since his hospital stay and now lives with their mom, Nicola, who works in social services, where she believes the experiences she's been through will help her support the families she now works with. I'll be right back after this final sponsor break. Now, as I love to do whenever I can, I'd like to end this episode by talking about who Moko was as a person. He may have been only three, but he had a big personality and left his mark on the world. Moko Xavier Rangito Hadidi has been described as
a little go-kart of a boy.
The New Zealand news site, Stuff, describes a home video taken of Moko just months before he was placed into Tanya's care.
Mischievous Moko Rangito Hadidi tears around the living room with an infectious smile and a cheeky grin. Laughter from cousins and aunties fills the room, but even that is drowned out by music. Moko's feet pick up the beat and he dances in that magic way only two-year-olds can. He catches the eye of everyone. He liked it that way. But his sister had her back turned. He sneaks up behind her, and a playful whap with a pillow brings her into the game.
A family member said of Moko,
"He was a little pocket rocket, always on the go and running around. The only thing that stopped him was the sound of big trucks. Every time he heard one, he would disappear behind a curtain or a door."
A friend said he loved seeing the big tractors around the different farms.
"They were like huge Tonka toys for him, but he would only sit in it if the door was open and the engine wasn't running. If you wanted to turn it on, he would say the door should always be open."
Moko often followed his koro, or grandfather, around. He couldn't make the K sound yet, so he called his grandpa Toro, which made his family laugh. Moko loved playing games like Go Fish. A family friend said,
"He always cheated at Go Fish, but he got away with a lot. I think his granddad still cheats at that game, so that might be where he got it from."
Moko also loved cartoons, especially Bob the Builder and SpongeBob SquarePants. The same family friend said,
"You always had to be quiet whenever Bob the Builder started. If you made any noise, he would turn around and give you a quick shush. He would always do a dance when it started. He'd watch the whole thing, singing along. Then he would run outside, grab a whole bunch of old tools, and start looking for things he could fix. Once he was keen to rip down the French doors so he could fix them."
Moko's Auntie Zina, his mummy's cousin, said,
"He was a bubbly, cheeky, as you can tell. He always smiled, like that smile that's in that picture. That's him. He always smiled."
Nicola told Duncan Garner about some of the other things Moko loved.
Moko used to like singing. He liked to be sung too. He was very energetic. He was very clever. Moko used to like fast cars. He used to love chasing trains. He used to love being in a car, traveling a lot.
Moko's favorite artist was British producer Naughty Boy, whose song, La La La, with vocals by British artist Sam Smith, was Moko's favorite song. "I'm covering my ears like a kid. When your words mean nothing, I go la la la. I'm turning up the volume when you speak. Cause if my heart can't stop it, I'll find a way to rock it. I go." Rest in peace, Moko. You'll never be forgotten. My sources for this episode were News Hub, One News, Stuff, The New Zealand Herald, NewZealand.com, New Zealand Tourism Guide, The Dominion Post, Te Karere, Wikipedia, Facebook, BBC, The New Zealand Ministry of Social Development, Radio New Zealand, UNICEF, YouTube, and Nicola Dalipaki. That's it for this week. Join me next week for another episode. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Spreaker, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes or become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to bonus content and exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook and Instagram. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. All music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. If you see something, say something. Until next week, bye everyone.